All right. So today we're going to speak about conflicts of interest situations. It's interesting because in secular law, the main focus in conflict of interest situations is upon judges. And obviously that's a major focus in halakha as well. But in addition to focusing upon judges, the next major focus in secular law is upon lawyers. Conflict of interest situations involving lawyers. Well, in halacha, the main two categories of individuals who are in the courtroom or involved in a judicial proceeding concerning whom there is an issue with respect to conflicts of interest are judges, but the other category is not lawyers, but rather witnesses. From a secular law perspective, there's very little focus upon conflicts of interest regarding witnesses. Anybody could really serve as a witness regardless of their conflict of interest. It could be a spouse in most cases. It could be somebody with a direct interest in the outcome of the litigation. It's something which obviously could be brought up, but it doesn't disqualify somebody from serving as a witness.
There are privileges that
sometimes bar people, and privileges that of course can be waived as well, but in terms of a person's connection to the case, it doesn't necessarily disqualify them from serving as a witness. While in halacha, one of the main sources of the whole discussion regarding conflict of interest, it has to do with witnesses. Really, the initial Gemara that kind of sets the stage for the entire discussion is with respect to whether a person can serve as a witness when they have a direct interest in the outcome of the case. Now, probably one of the reasons why halacha does not focus too much on a conflict of interest situations involving lawyers is because, as we've discussed in the past, halakha doesn't necessarily recognize the lawyer as an integral part of a judicial proceeding altogether. Who says that there's supposed to be a lawyer? So therefore, there isn't really much of a focus on lawyers. In fact, there's one authority, the Gidulei Truma, who's of the opinion that the more that a lawyer has an interest in a case, because they're getting paid for it, so probably the greater the justification for serving as a lawyer. Otherwise, we say, don't act as a lawyer because don't get involved in a dispute that does not pertain to yourself. So we say that if it's a relative, so then already there's more of a justification to get involved. There's a relative, you're getting paid for it, so maybe then there's something to argue about. So the greater the connection to the case, the more the justification for serving as an attorney. Now, of course, that's an oversimplification, because to the degree that the secular law has all kinds of laws relating to conflict of interest situations with an attorney, it's not situations where the attorney is aligned in terms of their interests in the case to the person who they're representing. It's when they have a conflict of interest that might prevent them from engaging in zealous advocacy on behalf of the person who they're representing. So in that case, and in that type of scenario, halakha would have something to say as well, but not necessarily from the perspective of conflict of interest, more from the perspective of the halakha, the mitzvah, that you shouldn't place a stumbling block in front of a blind person. And one of the explanations or applications of that rule, as Rashi explains in his Perush al Torah, is that you shouldn't give a person bad advice. You shouldn't tell a person, oh, you should sell your property at a cheap price, and really the incentive is that the person who's giving the advice is then going to buy the property cheap and sell it dear and make a profit off of the advice that they gave to somebody else to the other person's detriment. So too. Obviously, that same consideration would apply to somebody who's functioning as an attorney. The one should not represent somebody in a way where their own interests clash with the interests of the person they're representing, and that could be some type of an application of a lifnei iver. But let's focus from a halakhic perspective on the situations that actually arise on a regular or occasional basis in which one does have to worry about these types of conflicts of interest. So the Gemara talks about a conflict of interest with respect to somebody who sells a field, and then they want to testify when there's somebody else who's coming to take away the field, claiming that the field belongs to them, from the purchaser, and the seller says, I want to testify that this field really belongs to the purchaser. And we're talking about a situation where even if there is no achrayus, what we say, that there is no responsibility that the seller has extended to the purchaser, that once the purchaser loses the field, the seller is going to have to reimburse the purchaser. Nonetheless, let's say that the person who wants to collect the field from the purchaser is a baal chov, is a creditor of the seller, and because this was a subordinated field at the time that the seller became a debtor to the creditor, therefore the creditor is allowed to go after this field. So we still are. So we still say that the seller is not allowed to testify because they're even though they're not going to lose anything per se, in the sense that they don't have any fields of their own, because otherwise the creditor would go after their own fields. Nonetheless, and they're not going to lose anything because the purchaser is not going to be able to collect from the seller, since the seller did not take responsibility if the purchaser would lose the field. They still can't testify because they don't want to be a lo berasha v'lo yishalim. They don't want to be somebody who does not end up paying their debts to their creditor, and therefore they have an interest in this field remaining with the purchaser when somebody else comes along. Let's say that there is a third party who comes along and says, this field really belongs to me, and the creditor wants to say, no, the field really belongs to the purchaser, it really was mine originally, and now the creditor will be able to collect from that field afterwards. So that's a lo berasha v'lo yishalim. He's happy that the field will still be available so that he'll be able to pay his debt. And he won't be accused of being somebody who doesn't pay his debts. So the kasha that the Rishonim ask on this, the Maharami Wittenberg and the Rimi Gash ask on this conflict of interest, is that isn't it a greater conflict of interest, in the sense that if we're worried the person's going to make themselves into, they don't want to appear like a wicked person, so therefore they're going to do what? They're going to testify in a way in which they're going to be saying a lie. That's what we're worried about, because what is a conflict of interest really causing us to be concerned about? It's causing us to be concerned that the witness is not going to testify truthfully. So he'll testify, oh, this field really belongs to the purchaser, which means it really belongs to me. But he's really lying about that because he just wants the field to be available for his creditors to collect from. So that is, he doesn't want to look like a wicked person. So what does he do not to want to look like a wicked person? He's going to lie. So he'll be even more wicked because he'll be telling a lie. So what is he gaining? So there are two answers that are given to this question. One answer that is given to this question is that a person is much more comfortable lying between himself and a Kaddish Baruch Hu than looking like a wicked person in the eyes of his fellow man. It's like the old Ganav conundrum, that a person is prepared to steal in the dark of night, even though they're doing a terrible aveira, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu sees them because nobody else sees them, and somehow they're more fearful of their fellow man than they are of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So it's the old story. And the second answer that's given is that, no, it doesn't matter that the person is going to be a bigger Rasha by lying. We're not worried that the person is going to lie per se. What the only thing is that since the person has some type of an incentive for this field to remain in the hands of the purchaser, so that incentive, even if it's outweighed by some other incentive that he wouldn't want to lie, we don't care about that. We're not worried that he's going to lie. What we're worried about is that incentive, that connection to the litigation, makes the individual into a korov. It's considered like they're a baal dover. It's considered like they are a party themselves, and a party to a litigation cannot serve as a witness for somebody else to that litigation. So from these two answers emerge two different explanations as to the problem of what exists when you have a conflict of interest, meaning when a person has a stake in a litigation, a person has a stake in the outcome of a particular case. One explanation is that we're worried about shash mishakir. We're worried that the person is actually going to lie. Okay, that seems to be the Rambam's approach. That's the first approach. And the second consideration is that we're, that the person, even if we're not worried that they're going to lie, they're just considered to be inherently disqualified from being allowed to testify based on the fact that they are a baal dover. They're considered to be a party to the litigation, even if we're not worried that they're actually going to lie. So this could have all kinds of different ramifications as to what our concern is in a case of a conflict of interest. So if the concern is that a person is going to lie, let's say that they had a stake in the litigation and they testified, but they didn't know at the time that they testified that they had a stake. In other words, they didn't know that they had a connection to the case. Only after they rendered their testimony do they find out that they had a connection to the case. So the Sanzarov says, Divrei Chaim, says that this is a distinction between these two reasons. That if a person, if the problem with a person who's nogei b'dover, who has a conflict of interest, is that we're worried that they're going to lie, here we don't have to worry that the testimony is tainted by any kind of mendacity, because the person did not know that they had a stake in the case. On the other hand, if it's based on the person being a karov, a person being considered a relative of the litigant, or being an extension of the litigant, being a baal dover, so then if a person is automatically or intrinsically disqualified because of their connection to the case, and not because of our concern that they're going to lie, so then it will turn out that their testimony will have to be stricken anyway. So that's one possible distinction between these two different reasons.
How would anybody ever know that he didn't know?
Then it's just somehow nobody, it's stipulated. It's stipulated that the person did not know. Everyone stipulates, yeah, he didn't know at the time.
It seems like it's sort of impossible.
It could come up. It could that a person just that there is gets a letter in the mail that somehow this property belonged to a long lost relative that he didn't know was related to him, and everybody knows that the letter arrived and that there was no way that he could have known. It's announced. There was a big secret that they announced on the television. Some Houston billionaire died, and it's going to be announced in the next few days who the relatives really were. And then so everyone knows that it was disclosed somehow to the whole world at the same time. Yes?
In this day and age where we have, at least in the United States, you have title, and you can do title reports and abstracts and the like, would a Beit Din maybe say, look, we really want to know who's in the chain of custody for this property, so we're going to take a look at a title report. We want to know. All right. So
yes, to the degree, it's a very good question, to the degree that it's reasonable to assume that there is a cast of players who are involved in a case who could have a reasonable nexus to the litigation, and not all the players have been necessarily revealed to the Beis Din, so it would be the responsible thing, presumably, for the Beis Din to say, let's find out who all the players are so we can approach this responsibly and make sure that there are no individuals who are playing a role in this litigation that they should not be playing. But sometimes it's impossible to know because people can have all kinds of different connections with respect to a case.
That's fine. They did ever give like a requirement, for example, when I file an action regarding real estate, I have to notice of anybody who I have reasonable knowledge. You know, I would have to do my due diligence to find out who has reasonable knowledge on this piece of real estate or this interest in property or whatever. And then I may have to publish notice in the Chicago Daily Law Bulletin. Would the bank say, okay, we want you to go publish, you know, in a newspaper or whatever for 2 weeks?
It really depends on what the nature of the litigation is. You know, let's say, for example, we've had some cases where there was a dispute regarding a construction job that was done on a property, with somebody saying, oh, that there were a contractor job that was done on the property. Somebody saying this contractor didn't do a good job with respect to the work that was done on the property, and if I want my money back, I don't want to have to pay the rest of my fee. And the other person says no, I did an excellent job. And then the one who said that it was a really lousy job brings in an expert to testify about how terrible a job it was that the first contractor had done. So one thing that the Beis Din will do as a matter of course would be to ask this quote-unquote expert, do you have a stake in this litigation? Are you being hired to do the restorative or the reparative work with respect to this property, and you're demanding money for the work that you're doing, so therefore you would have a stake in bringing the litigation or trying to substantiate the claim that the first contractor did a lousy job. So sometimes the situation itself just kind of begs the question as to whether the person has a stake in the litigation, and then the Bezdin tries to draw that out. But to identify the entire cast of people in the world who might have a stake in the litigation is pretty much an unwieldy task. I don't think that that's something that would always be necessitated as a matter of course. Now, another possible nafkamina, another possible distinction between these two reasons would be exactly what we mentioned before. We said that we asked Akasha, we said, oh, if a person doesn't want to be considered to be wicked, so he wants his creditor to have access to this property, so why would he become wicked by lying? So we gave a distinction, we gave an answer. We said, oh, because a person might prefer not to be wicked in the eyes of man than acting in a way which is wicked only in the eyes of God. Well, only God knows. So if you had a situation where it was wickedness sort of on the same plane, where a person, we're worried that a person is going to lie because they'll get a certain benefit if they lie, but on the other hand, if they lie, it could also cause them a tremendous detriment. And both detriments would be in the eyes of man. Let's say you had a situation where lying could give them a certain benefit because they have a certain connection to the case, but it also could lead to a terrible detriment to them as well. So if the two different considerations balance or cancel each other out, so we would say if what we're worried about is a chashash mishakir, that the person is going to lie, so then if the lying is going to end up creating a greater detriment than benefit, so then we're not worried about the lying. But if what we're worried about is that the fact that the testimony implicates the person, the witness, in some fashion, that there is some type of a benefit or connection that they have to the outcome of the case, even if it's a mixed sort of connection that they have to the case, that there might be certain benefits, but there might be certain burdens. So then we would say that we're not going to allow the testimony in that case because the person is just intrinsically disqualified by virtue of being a karov to the case. All right. Another possible nafkamina would be, do we allow the person to testify solely to their detriment? So it happens, the halacha is that we do allow the person to testify solely to their detriment if they have a connection to the case. But here you can also argue that maybe that should depend on this very same question. If they're a karov and they're automatically disqualified because of their connection, so then we should say that they shouldn't even be believed to testify to their detriment. But if it's based upon a chashash mishakir that they're going to lie, so why would anybody in their right mind lie to their detriment? They should only lie to their benefit, so therefore they should be believed. So the fact that we paskin, that we hold the halakha, that if a person testifies to their detriment, then that's considered to be a waiver of the problem of nogeya bedover, of the conflict of interest. So how do you get around that? So one way that you get around that is that you say that once the person has changed the situation so that they can only suffer from their testimony and that they cannot benefit from their involvement in the case, so then they cease to have a connection to the case. That sort of removes, that's a way of them being misalik their connection, that it's a way in which they're able to expunge any kind of an interest that they would have had in the outcome of the litigation. And there's some precedent for this, because the Gemara...
How about the Mason of Festival Russia?
Yeah, so?
So... Then you shouldn't accept?
No, because this isn't making the person into a Rasha. This is Hodas Baal Din. Remember, in a monetary case, you're never making yourself into a Rasha if you testify in a way that you're going to end up losing money. That's not considered to be Mesim Esasma Rasha. So the Gemara in Baba Basra talks about a case where, for example, you have, just look at the end of source one, Betanya, most of the other sources I've said on the outside already, Bnei Ir, or the first number of sources, Betanya Bnei Ir Shenignav Sefer Torah Shelahem. If you have people of a city where their Sefer Torah was stolen, Ein Donim Medayana Osa Ir, you don't judge the case with the judges of that city, Ve'mevin Raya Me'anshe Osa Ir. And you can't bring any kind of a proof from the people who live in the city because everybody is going to benefit from keeping the Sefer Torah within their city, so they're not trusted to testify as to whether the Sefer Torah belongs to this city or to a different city. So the Gemara says, Well, why can't you have siluk? Lisalku beitrei minayu v'lidainu. Have it to two people who will remove themselves from the case, will remove themselves from the shul, where the Sefer Torah is read, so that they're not going to have any connection to the Sefer Torah. So the Gemara says, well, that's not going to work if it's a city where there's only one shul, and they're always going to benefit from the Sefer Torah no matter what. But if it's a city where they have more than one shul, and you can have two people who say, we'll judge the case, and we're never going to have any benefit from the Sefer Torah again, because we're going to remove ourselves from the shul, so then that should be okay. So just take a look at Tosfos in source 4, and then I'll take your question. So Tosfos asks the question, Bim Tomer, but we have a general principle when it comes to a person being able to serve as a witness. They have to be kosher, qualified to serve as a witness, both at the beginning of the litigation and the end of the litigation. But here, at the beginning of the litigation, they were puzzled, because when the case originally arose, they were essentially disqualified from being able to serve in a judicial capacity. The Omeri, so the Re answers, the Lo Shayat Kilaso Bepaslus Hocha, Kimen She'em Paslus Toli Beguf, Ela Bemamon. So the Re, Tosos gives an answer that says that when is it that I require that a person be qualified to testify from the very beginning until the very, very end? That is only when there is an intrinsic disqualification in the person. But when it's only based on some type of a monetary connection, so then that's not going to be a problem. So here too, you could say that this also seems to support the position that the nature of the disqualification is that I'm afraid that the person is not going to be entirely truthful based on their monetary connection, and not based on their being a kohen, based on their actually being considered a litigant themselves and having an intrinsic psul, because if it was an intrinsic disqualification, then presumably that would be a problem even if they had it at the beginning, and then they just got rid of it. They somehow were able to expunge it. They were able to eradicate it over the course of time. So that's another question as to how we would understand this. Now, there are Rishonim and Achronim who do still understand that the nature of the disqualification is that the person is a Baal Dover, that they are connected to the case, and the way that they would understand how they could remove themselves from the beginning to the end is that this is kind of like a fungible sort of Baal Dover, that this is a Baal Dover that is defined as a Baal Dover based on a specific moment in time. That it's not like somebody who's born with a particular intrinsic, connection to the case or to an individual who's litigating the case. It's based on the subject matter. So once the subject matter goes away, so then you don't have this problem anymore. Now, it's interesting that the Rush, if you look in Source 5, the Rush brings a very interesting opinion that distinguishes between a judge and a witness in this regard. He quotes from Rabbi Meir, and he says that maybe there's a distinction between if the person is serving as a dayan, as a judge, or whether the person is serving as a witness. He says, the siluk, removing oneself from the conflict and just making the conflict go away, mo'el agabe din dayan, that should work, that maybe that works only for a dayan, mo'el agabe edus, and not for a witness. Because maybe for a witness, it really is an intrinsic disqualification to be in tchilasa himself and mekashrus. And he says that he found a Rabbeinu Yehuda who says this as well. He says, Shehadayin udan al taino shetan lefanam akash nistalik. The dayan is going to judge the case based on the arguments that are presented in front of the dayan after he has removed any conflict from the case. So therefore, at the time that the arguments are made in front of the dayan no longer has a connection with the case. But the witnesses, they're testifying about what they saw, the Ocha Hayunogim Bedava, when they still did have a connection to the case, and therefore he says it's going to be more problematic with respect to witnesses removing themselves from a case in the middle of the litigation. Now, the Maharsham, yes?
Sorry.
Oh, okay.
I understand with the dayan, but with the witness, let's say we have this in secular law as well, where your best witness has some sort of intrinsic connection, and let's say, in secular law, there's no privilege, there are people, you can't impeach them, they're obviously,
right.
You allow that witness to testify. Here, you know, Reuven is a member of the shul. He's walking home from the makole. He saw somebody running out of the shul with a package, jumped into a car, speeding away. He called 911 from his cell phone and gave the last four digits of the license plate. He's the best factual witness. He saw what happened. He can testify and say, I saw somebody run into this car, which we now know is Shimon's car.
Right.
And yet we would still not allow him to testify, even though he's the best factual witness in kosher and all other aspects, simply because he's a dues-paying member of the shul.
Well, it depends on how close the connection is. And also, it depends on how feasible it is to have this type of a standard. There is a takana that is brought by some of the Achronim that in many communities, if let's say you had a dispute regarding a Sefer Torah, and everybody has a stake in it, and it's not realistic to find somebody who's not going to have a stake, so then there's a takana to say that, well, even if a person is part of the community and they have a stake, since otherwise we're not going to reasonably be able to litigate these types of cases, so we make a takana that we're not going to disqualify people. So you can do that as well. The Rama speaks about this in Siman, at the end of Siman Lamed Daled, the end of Siman Lamed Hey, where if the only people who could have seen a certain incident are people who otherwise would have been disqualified, so sometimes we'll allow their testimony under those circumstances. But here we're talking about where that doesn't necessarily have to be the case, where I can do justice without bringing in people who have a conflict of interest in the case. I don't need to have a takana.
Even if they're the best, you know, for no other reason.
But they're not the best if there's some sort of a problem with them, then they're not necessarily the best. Again, according to the Rama, I have like a fight in the women's section. He talks about how women can't normally be witnesses. There's a fight, a fist fight that breaks out in the women's section. You have a good machitza, and the only people who could see the fight are the women. So he says, okay, well then you could bring them in to testify because less braver. You don't have any other choice because they're the best people and the only people who are available in this particular situation. But that's not what we're talking about over here.
What we're talking about here, is it civil matter of ownership, or does it include the criminal geneva itself? If you witness a geneva,
right,
you have to stop the geneva. I mean, the best answer is probably,
well, to stop a crime, anybody can stop a crime, that's for sure. But you know, testimony. But here we're talking about, these are civil matters. We're talking about monetary matters. That's what we're talking about. Yes?
Is this talking about a situation where the town has only one Sefer Torah, and if they don't testify, then the funds for a new Sefer Torah will be raised from the community? So in essence, they are Nogea.
They are completely Nogea B'Davers. They keep the Sefer Torah within their own community. If I'm talking about criminal matters, very often it's not a question of having a stake in a criminal matter the way that you have a stake in a civil matter. That's a very different story.
I'm saying that the problem with having them as witnesses is if they don't testify, then they will have to pay for a new Sefer Torah.
Yes. Of course. In other words, they're going to benefit from keeping the Sefer Torah here. If you don't have the Sefer Torah here, number one, they're not going to benefit from it anymore. Number two, they're going to have to pay for another Sefer Torah. Now, you look at source 6, the Maharsham draws another distinction between witnesses and judges, and this is very, very interesting. He says that if we assume that the problem with a witness is that the witness is going to potentially lie, so he says we don't generally have a chshad with respect to our fellow Jews that they're ever going to lie. That's what he says. So therefore, he says it's very possible that this is not a deraisa concern. That meaning that min haTorah, even if somebody is the nogea b'davar, then that might only be a psul midrabanan. If I say that the person who's a nogea b'davar is really a baal davar himself, that he's actually considered to be the party in interest, so I could say that then the person is disqualified on a Torah level, right? Because on a Torah level, a person is not allowed to testify regarding themselves. You need to have separate edim. You need to have separate witnesses. Your baal davar can't serve as a witness in his or her own case. So he says that if I assume that the only problem is a kshash l'shakir problem, that the person might lie, so maybe that's only midrabanan. But he says with a dayan, it's different. He says with a dayan, it's possible that it's worse. Because if a judge has an interest in the litigation, So while on the one hand, the Rush quoted Rabbeinu Yehuda as saying that a dayan could be better if he removes himself from the case in the middle, because when the case is actually presented in court, he doesn't have an interest at that point in time. Maybe that's better than a witness who removes himself from the case in the middle because he's testifying about what he saw beforehand when he still did have an interest in the case. But in terms of when the psul is applicable, he says it's possible that it's much more severe with respect to a dayan. Why would that be? He says with a dayan, the consideration is not, I'm afraid that the dayan is going to lie. The dayan is not testifying that we have to lie. What am I worried about with respect to a judge, with respect to a fact finder? I'm worried that he's going to be jaded or prejudiced based on his predilections, based on his connections to the case. Because the dayan has an interest, if the dayan has an interest in a particular outcome, so therefore that's something which is more in the category of something which would be much more problematic. He says about Gabi Dayan, Tali Benatiya Sadas, the Kuliyama Psu Miyokas Torah. Everybody would agree that the Psu would be on a Torah level. So it could actually be that even though the Gemara first brings this concept of an Ogeo Bedover, or somebody who has a conflict of interest, somebody who has a connection to the case with respect to a witness, and we're just extrapolating and applying it to Dayanim as well, it could be that it's really in the opposite direction that Arsham says. It could be that a Dayan is really worse. What would be the problem? I avoided saying the word. What do you think the problem would be with respect to a dayan? Shochad, exactly. So the Chazon Ish has an essay about this. Interestingly enough, the Chazon Ish has many, many treatises on halacha, as you very well know. He wrote the Chazon Ish. Chazon Ish and Or HaChaim, Yerideh, you name it. He writes on everything, you know, Dalach Hilkei Shulchan Aruch. But his essay on this particular topic is not in the Sefer Chazon Ish. You know where his essay on this topic appears? It appears in his Hashkafa Sefer. It appears in his philosophical treatise, which is called Emuna Ubitachon. He talks about having faith and having trust in HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So he has a paragraph there in the Sefer. It's in Perek Gimel. I have a little excerpt here in Source 10. Perek Gimel, or Shar Gimel, it's the third section, Perek Lamed, the 30th chapter of the third section, and he says that the problem with a judge who has a connection to the case is v'chol zeh b'chlal chukei mitzvah shehusharnu mimekach shochad, that it's all included within shochad. Because what does the word shochad mean? What does the word shochad mean? Anybody know? Shehuchad. That if a judge takes a bribe from one of the parties, that causes the judge to become equivalent to the party who paid the bribe to the judge. That the judge is now sees things exactly the same way as that party. It's not based on it being nefarious per se, because shochad is not applicable when a person gives money to a judge and says, I want you to judge the case in my favor. That's called lo sasu avil b'mishpat. That's perversion of justice. That's a separate prohibition. Shochad is even when a party gives the judge money and says, I want you to decide the case fairly. The fact that this party has given money to the judge now causes the judge to see things, be more likely to see things in the way of the person who gave the judge the money, even though the person says, you don't have to decide, like, according to me, I'm giving you $100,000, but you don't have to decide, you know, according to my side of the case. You decide however you feel it's right. It doesn't matter. Now the judge has been permanently joined this. That's what's called shochad. So the same idea, and the Chazon Ish points to a case, points to a Gemara that talks about, if you turn a little bit to Source 20, it talks about when a decision had to be made about Iber Hashanah, about extending the months of the year, whether to extend the months of the year or not. So the Gemara says that there are two people who are not allowed to be involved in that determination. One is the Melech, one is the king, and the other is the Kohen Gadol. Why can't the king be involved in that determination? The king can't be involved in that determination because the king pays a certain amount of money for all the soldiers who provide service to the king over the course of a year. If it would be a leap year, it's still the same amount of money that the king pays. So the king always has an interest in making a leap year because he gets more bang out of his buck. He's able to pay the same amount for all of the soldiers, for all of the workers, for all of the governmental workers. It's great for the budget that you get them to work the entire year, but it's 13 months instead of 12 months, and you don't have to increase the budgetary spending during that time. So therefore, the Melech is going to be considered to be jaundiced. The other is the Kohen Gadol. What's the Kohen Gadol's consideration? The Kohen Gadol has to run around on Yom Kippur like crazy. He has to be tovel himself 5 times, do Kiddush Yadayim Raglayim 10 times. He has to offer all of these different sacrifices, and he's running around the entire time on the floor. Okay, he's not allowed to wear shoes. There can't be like a chatzitza between himself and the floor, and the floor is really cold. Okay, the later in the year it is, so the colder it's going to be. So therefore, from the Kohen Gadol's perspective, he doesn't want a leap year. If you're going to make a leap year, that means Yom Kippur is going to come out closer to the winter time, and the floor is going to be much colder, and he really doesn't want that. This is his most difficult day of the year. He's hungry. He's got all kinds of other things. He has to do like a lot of work, and if he does it wrong, a lot of Kohanim Gedolim didn't emerge alive from the Kodesh HaKadoshim, and to be cold in addition, like that would be too much. So the Kohen Gadol, therefore, might be prejudiced when it comes to the determination of the Ibur Hashanah in terms of how cold the floor is going to be. So therefore, both of them are disqualified. So says the Chazon Ish that the Gemara essentially considers Kiddush HaKodesh to be a mishpat. It's considered to be a judgment that has to be made. And because it's a judgment, anything that enters within the realm of judgment, the Torah tells us, v'shochad lo sikach, that you have to have considerations of shochad. And we see here, shochad is not merely that you're going to, that one party is being paid off, but shochad is that a person's going to be prejudicial in terms of their inclination. So you turn back to the Chazon Ish, source 10, so that's how he proceeds this discussion. He says, in the Pasuk, because Ibur Hashanah is called Mishpat, and therefore that's considered to be, he says, the part of the Ashara of Mekach Shokat, because if there is somebody who is Nogeya B'Dover, that's considered to be a source of Shokat. It doesn't have to be that it's an outright bribe. And he makes reference to the Gemara in Ksuvos. The Gemara in Ksuvos has all kinds of different cases of individuals who are supposed to serve as dayanim on cases, and then the party who was supposed to appear before them did something nice for them. Not that they gave money, that you would call this shokad per se, but the problem, says the Chazon Ish, is that it creates a negiyas, it creates some type of a closeness that the dayan develops with the party. Like, for example, we'll give the Gemara gives a couple of cases. Take a look about 5 lines down, the Gemara in Ksuba Sandaf Kopeyim and Beis. Tanam Abanim Shokad Lo Sikach. Eino Tzarek Loma Shokad Mamon. Obviously, Shokad Mamon, we all understand. We all understand monetary bribes. That doesn't require, you don't even need to give a shir about that. That's kind of like, you know, pretty self-evident, right? But he says that Lafido Shokad Dvarim Nami Aser, even if it's not something which is an outright giving of money, it also creates this problem. What's the problem, says the Chazon Ish? It creates a Nogeya B'Dova kind of problem. Hechi Dami, what are examples? Yad Shmuel Ava Avra Mimibra. Shmuel is crossing over some type of a narrow, rickety bridge. Also, Gava Yad LeYadeh, somebody pulls out his hand, extends his hand to Shmuel to help him navigate his way across the bridge. So Amalei Maya Bintach. So he says, what are you doing here? In other words, why are you near, you know, why are you in this area today as I'm walking across this rickety bridge to get to the courtroom, so to get to the courthouse? So Amalei Dina Isli says, oh, it happens that I have a case today, and Shmuel is the judge. So Amalei Pasil Nalach Ladina. So Shmuel says, well, if that's the case, if you have a case, then I am not going to be able to serve as your dayan. And a Maimer, next example is a Maimer was sitting and he was judging cases. Parak Gadba Reshe, there was a bird that landed on his head. Also Gaba Shakle, so somebody who's sitting there in the room shoos the bird away. Amalei Maravitek, he said, why are you in the room? Amalei Dina Isli, he says, because I have a case today. Amalei Pasino Lakladina, if that's the case, then I'm not going to be able to adjudicate your matter. Okay? And the Gemara gives additional examples of this. Ma'ukva had some spittle in front of him, and somebody came along and cleaned up the spittle. So Amalei Maravitek, what are you doing here? He says, Dina Isli, he says, I have a din today. Amalei Pasino Lakladina, he says, if so, then I'm not going to be able to adjudicate your case. And we find this throughout. The Gemara has many, many different examples of this. So says the Chazon Ish, so these examples that the Gemara gives, it's because there was a feeling that the Dayanim had that they create, entered into some type of a connection with the litigant that made it impossible for them to judge the case completely, fairly, and squarely without being jaded or biased. And in fact, if you go on, the Gemara gives an illustration of how this bias was manifested. Because it tells the story about Rabbi Shmuel and Rabbi Yossi. He had a sharecropper who would bring the fruit that he owed to Rabbi Shmuel and Rabbi Yossi every single week. And one week he brought it a little bit early. And he said, why are you bringing it early? So he said, oh, well, since I have a case in front of you today, I guess he wasn't disqualified by virtue of being a sharecropper, but he was, that was considered an arm's length relationship. But he said that I have a din with you today, and I figured that since I have a din, and I'm coming to see you anyway, so I'll bring the fruit that I owe you one day early, so he wouldn't accept it from him, and he said, I'm disqualified from serving as a dayan. And then he appointed others to hear the case, and the entire time that he was watching the case, Rabbi Shmuel and Rabbi Yossi was watching the case, he kept on thinking of ways that he could argue on behalf of the sharecropper. So he said, oh, I see from here, Tepuk Navsham Shel Makabli Shokhan, Umani Shlo Natalti, Ibn Natalti, Shali Natalti, that I didn't even take the fruit, and if I had taken it, I was entitled to the fruit cock, but I already developed a predisposition. I already developed a netia, a favoritism towards this party. Mekabli shokhan alachas kamer v'kamer. Somebody who really took a bribe, how much more so that they would be inclined in the direction of the party who gave them the money. So all of this is based on this principle of a conflict of interest, of having a negia, of having some type of an interest in the outcome of the case. So according to the Chazon Ish, we understand what the Maharsham is saying, that the real d'oraisa problem, it's a much more serious problem with respect to the judge, that for a judge who has any kind of an interest in the litigation, it really could create a d'oraisa problem. Now, from Avshochan, now what the Chazon Ish also goes on to say is that this is a concept which is only expressed with respect to the actual, the actual adjudication of monetary cases. The Chazon Ish is a very, very interesting essay. He says, it's not because we really are suspicious of great rabbis. The great rabbis are going to show favoritism towards a particular party, even if they have a connection with that party. It's because of the fact that the Torah tells us that when it comes to mishpat, when it comes to the adjudication of monetary cases, there is this thing called shochad. There is this blinding force, right? It's a blinding force that can affect even people who are great rabbis. But if not for the fact that the Torah establishes this in the context of judicial proceedings, and by extension, Kiddush HaKodesh, because that's a judicial proceeding, it's not right to cast aspersions upon rabbinic figures just because they might have some connection to the outcome of a particular decision, to say, oh, well, of course they paskin the particular way because they're going to be benefited by this decision. We cannot give that, we cannot cast that aspersion or place that assumption upon a decision, let's say when it comes to a kashrus matter or something which is non-monetary. He says that we have no right to do that because we don't generally suspect, certainly a dayan, of engaging in outright lying or an outright perversion of justice. It's just because when it comes to monetary cases, it's a special chiddush that the Torah tells us that then there's this thing called shochad that happens and that can inflict even great rabbis. So he says, like, for example, right now we just completed Pesach. Let's say that a person is a great rabbi and they have a stash of liquor, okay, that is worth thousands upon thousands of dollars, and it belongs to them, and there's a question as to whether it was properly sold prior to Pesach. And it's a halakha question, and it requires a resolution. If it turns out that it was not properly sold and it's coming to other love of Pesach, then he has to throw the whole thing out. He can't get any benefit from it, and he loses thousands and thousands of dollars. And if it turns out that it was properly done, so then he's able to save thousands and thousands of dollars. It says the Chazon Ish, if the person in question is a great rabbi, he does not have to ship out his question to somebody else, because this is not a monetary case between himself and another party. This is simply a case of a halakhic question in the realm of Yoredeya, even though it does have monetary ramifications, that a person is allowed to decide on their own. They are allowed. They have the right to make that determination on their own. And therefore, we do not suspect somebody simply because they have an interest in the outcome of not being able to paskin a shilas. That's very, very important. Yes?
Being if hashos are considered dating mamonos for this effect or no? Meaning you can have a case, I assume, where you know you can have someone with just no money whatsoever at stake. I don't know if the judge could potentially be somehow.
I would think so. I think so. So the answer is I think so. You know, in terms of a judge's interest, I think so. Yes, because that's also mishpat. Yeah.
How far would we take this? Would we extend it to the judge's family, to parents, siblings?
So one of the questions is, let's say that somebody has a connection in a case, and then they have a relative, right? So it has been suggested that it could very well be that this is another distinction between whether you hold that the disqualification is based on having a conflict. It's based on the conflict causing you to not be truthful, or whether this disqualification is based on being viewed as a karov, or being viewed as a relative, or a baal dover, or an actual litigant to the case. So if we say that the psul is that you are considered because you have a conflict, an actual litigant in the case, so then your relatives are relatives of the litigants in the case, and therefore they also couldn't testify, right? But if the problem is because we're worried that you're going to lie because you have a stake in the outcome, but your relatives don't necessarily have the same stake in the outcome that you have, right? So therefore, they are not necessarily going to be suspected of lying just because you have a stake in the outcome of the case, so it would not automatically disqualify the relatives. So it's been suggested that might be another nafkamina between the two different reasons, and you find Mishonim who go in both directions when it comes to that question. Yes?
Would the Chazon Ish be against the Zavala process?
So that's very, very interesting, because one of the questions is, can a dayan serve on a case if the litigant, if one of the litigants is a friend of the dayan? And the halacha is that the dayan, that if it's like their best friend, of course not, if it's a friend who's just sort of a casual friend, so then it's not proper, but if the judge heard the case, the din would still be good. And we say that with respect to an aide, with respect to a relative, the fact that somebody is a friend is not an automatic disqualification. Why is that? Because the friendship is not a monetary stake in the litigation, right? What is the problem of the friendship? The problem of the friendship is more this other consideration, namely that the dayan might not be able to think straight. That's not necessarily a consideration with respect to a witness, where I'm worried, is the witness considered to be a baal dover? Is the witness going to lie? If I'm not worried about that, all that I'm really worried about is this going to unconsciously or subconsciously affect the dayan's thinking? And that's going to be much more of a concern with respect to a dayan, right?
Because it seems to be here, you just say hello to somebody, and
right. So that's much more a concern.
Yeah.
Like, for example, if you turn to, for example, source number 8, okay? So 8 says, nine. So 9 is the Sma saying that when it comes to somebody who's a friend, or somebody you don't like so much, so that's not a problem when it comes to rendering testimony. Why? A person is simply testifying about whatever happened. We're not worried the person is going to alter their testimony because they happen to like somebody or dislike them. But when it comes to judging a case, that requires a reasoning. Even if there are no bad thoughts about it. So therefore, all of that has to come into consideration. This is very, very important. When we hear cases here in Chicago, it is often the case, just because it's a small community, that a person will appear before the Bezin as someone who's known to us, or they might be, you know, one degree of separation. They might be the son or father or son-in-law or sister-in-law or daughter of somebody who we know. So the way that we begin every single case at the CRC is we say, okay, how does everybody know each other? So that all of these associations can be disclosed, and the dayanim have to make an assessment as to whether they feel that they can be completely impartial, but there has to be disclosure. And some, if there's a monetary interest in the outcome of the case, it doesn't matter how much disclosure you're going to give, that's going to be a disqualification. But if it's a question of that there's no interest in the outcome of the case, but you just know one of the parties, it's not necessarily a disqualification issue, but it is a disclosure issue, that a dayan has to at least disclose any association so the parties can always be comfortable. What I find interesting is that the parties are always comfortable. That because once there's a feeling that the dayanim have a sense of integrity, and also it's hard to find, you know, people who don't know each other or don't know relatives of each other here in Chicago, so people are kind of accepting of that reality. But dayanim have to be very, very careful. You look at source 14, this is where the Shulchan Aruch codifies this and says, "Dvarim elu tulim adas adayin." These things are very much dependent upon a dayan's assessment. They should know what type of connection creates other considerations and other desires for a particular outcome. So that's true with respect to a witness. Like you have an expert contractor. Does this expert contractor really have themselves perhaps an interest in the outcome of this case based on their business? Even if it's very far-fetched, then you shouldn't allow someone to be a witness. But even if there is some sort of remote connection, a person should realize that they shouldn't be a dayan in a case. So a dayan has to make that assessment. But if dayan feels that they don't have enough of a connection, it's just that they happen to know a person, but they feel they can judge fairly. And the Gemara assumes that. The Gemara assumes a Rebbe can be a dayan for his Talmud. And then the question is, you know, that they're having a chavusa. Does it look bad if they have their chavusa right before the Rebbe is going to hear the case of the Talmud? But the Gemara recognizes that that doesn't necessarily create a problem, that it is possible to be objective. But these things, these types of relationships require, at the very least, a disclosure. So that's something that the Dayanim have to do, is a disclosure. Now, one other thing that might join this, the Dayan, this is mentioned by the Shach in source 16, is that the Shulchan Aruch mentions, this was source 15 right beforehand, that a Dayan is not allowed to hear one party's presentation before the other party. And the Rama says it's only if the Dayan knows that he's going to be a Dayan, because we have a halakha, Shmo Menachem Shrat Tem Tzedek. You're not allowed to hear one person's claim unless it's Bein Achikem with the other person present. But if he didn't know, so that doesn't necessarily disqualify him. Aval, however, he says, if he provides a disclosure that he heard from one side without hearing from the other side, the other side says that's okay, that's not a disqualification. Says the Shach, there's one exception to this rule in which he cannot, under any circumstances, serve as the Dayan, and that is if he already wrote what his opinion was. If he he said, here is my decision, I'm writing you what I think your decision in the case is, and then the other party comes along and says, okay, let's have a din Torah about it. Then he can't paskin. Why? The chashiv can nogeah, because then he's considered to be a nogeah. But what's the nature of his nogeah, his negias? Because avid inish nevaksik, the avid laksik b'tibure. Because a person, once they have expressed an opinion about something, they will want that opinion to be validated and substantiated, and they're less likely to go against what they already decided. That's why when they had the big smicha controversy in Israel, and the Yaakov Beirav decided he's going to reinstitute smicha, then he had 25 rabbis, he was in spotting, and 25 rabbis appoint him as a rabbi, and then he conferred smicha upon Rabbi Yosef Cairo and upon others as well. So the Maharal Bach in Yerushalayim was very upset about this. He felt it was against halakha, and mostly, and he was also upset that he wasn't invited. So it led to a major, major controversy. And the Maharal Bach said, now that you did this, and you yourself were appointed a rabbi, you were given smicha because of your psak, we can't even have a new convening of this issue with all of the rabbis. Even if I would be invited, we wouldn't be able to revisit this psak because you're not going to go against your original psak because you already joined this because of the fact that you already gained from it because you received the smicha. So therefore, now it's too late even to remediate or to rectify the situation. Yes.
Why is he writing a decision in a case he hasn't heard? It's because somebody told him some facts.
It happens all the time. Do you know how often I am approached by people who say, I just want you to give my opinion. Does it sound like, you know, I'm in the right over here? Does it sound like, based on what I'm telling you, that my position is correct? It happens all the time. And I always have to say, no, I'm sorry. I can't, you know, tell you my opinion unless the other, unless I hear from the other side as well. But it happens all the time. I can't, I can't overstate just how often this occurs.
What should I do?
Yes. Yes, procedurally, you could tell people procedurally this is how you go about bringing your case and bringing about a resolution to the case, that sort of conversation. You have to be very, very careful about these types of conversations. And it's interesting, the Shach even alludes. He alludes to the Ma'arav Bach, says, V'chein kasa Ma'arav Bach, Bigeras HaSmicha Shelo. He called it the Igeras HaSmicha, when she took issue to Rav Yaakov Beirav. So here's, you don't find too much discussion about the Smicha controversy anywhere in the Shulchan Aruch, but if you want to find it anywhere, you find it in this particular Shach. So let's see, how much time do we have? We have 6 minutes. So I'm going to bring something very interesting in the remaining 6 minutes.
So this is one of the reasons why the COC is out of Abramson, because the people come from the Shulchan.
Exactly. That's why you need a Menayel. So the Menayel is like the gatekeeper who's able to hear from the parties individually so that the Dayanim themselves don't have to be joined. That's 100% right. That's why it's so important to have what we call the Menayel or the Shliach Bezdin. That's one very, very important role that Shliach Bezdin plays. For these purposes. So in the case of Bush versus Gore, you remember that it was actually a presidential election into the year 2000, so there was some question about chads and ballots. What? Hanging chads, some ballots in South Florida, you may recall, Jewish grandmothers voting for Pat Buchanan, you know, you may recall. So there was a question about the recount, whether they should allow another recount and so forth, and eventually it made its way to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court heard the case. And the Supreme Court ruled in Gore's favor that they were stopping, you know, any attempt for any further recount. Now, what's not as well known, and I can't, you know, vouch necessarily for the veracity of this, is that there was an article that appeared in the American Bar Association Journal after William Rehnquist, who was the Supreme Court at the time, passed away, saying, by one of his best friends, saying, oh, Bill and I had a great time, you know, we and our wives were best friends with each other, and unbeknownst to the rest of the world, we used to engage in friendly wagers, you know, from time to time. And at the time of the 2000 election, we had engaged in a friendly wager because, you know, he would like bet on who's going to win the election, you know, funny stuff like that. Then after we had wagered on the election and he had wagered that Bush was going to win by a certain percentage and so forth, he realized that this case was likely to come in front of the Supreme Court. So he wrote the following letter. This is source 17. So on the same day, Bill faxed the following letter to Betty Nan and me. Dear Obie and Betty Nan, it now appears remotely possible that the Florida election case might come to our court. I therefore feel obliged to cancel all my election bets in any way dependent on the Florida vote. I hope you will agree to let me do this. Sincerely, Bill Rehnquist. And the article goes on to say, needless to say, we did. You know, like very, very nice, you know, funny story and so forth. And I'm reading this and thinking, wow, this is like a big deal, potentially. You know, it didn't really make tremendous waves, in part because, you know, most lawyers who get the ABA Journal don't read any of the articles because it's tediously boring. But this particular article was actually interesting. So I saw afterwards that there was one person who wrote a letter saying, respectfully, it was a banal article, but for one horrible disclosure, the Chief Justice not only bet for money on presidential elections, but had the audacity to attempt to withdraw from his likely illegal bet when it appeared that his court would decide the 2000 election. The cat was out of the bag. You can't, just as one cannot withdraw from a consummated crime, one cannot eradicate an illegal conflict of interest. So this is a question, you know, from a halakhic standpoint, do we say that this becomes a problematic conflict of interest? We spoke already about the possibility of a judge removing a conflict of interest by, you know, removing that right to, by shutting away that conflict of interest. And we saw how maybe it's even better in the case of a judge than a witness, because when he's actually hearing the case, he doesn't have the conflict of interest anymore. The only real question would be whether it falls into the Shach's category of a situation where the judge had already rendered an opinion. Do we say that through that bet he had already rendered an opinion that the outcome would be a particular way, and then there would be a problem of amida inish lafzuke b'dibure? So there, perhaps, one can still draw a distinction between a preference and a prediction. You could say, well, the fact that one is making a prediction is not necessarily indicating that they want a particular outcome. Do we still say, oh, but Avinash Lakzuke Vidibure, that he still would want to show that his prediction was correct, and therefore that's something to be taken into consideration. From a halakhic perspective, I would say that, if, again, the person who this was written about would had already died before the article was written, so therefore you can't assume the truth of anything. But nonetheless, from a halakhic perspective, I would say that probably this would warrant at least disclosure, and then, you know, a decision would have to be made, you know, on the basis of that disclosure.
When it says, Dvorim Elu Tluim Bedas Hadayim, so does that mean that one of the Bali Din cannot say, wait a minute, I'm not happy with your, I think you are too connected.
Generally speaking,
who decides, you know, do they have the right to, does a Bali Din have the right
generally
to?
Generally speaking, the proper course of conduct for any Dayan is that if a party says, I'm not comfortable, based on what we are reasonable connections to the case, this judge sitting on the case, and the judge will recuse himself from the case. It becomes more complicated when the case has already been going on for a long time, and it's party decides at that point in time that they're uncomfortable because there is a secretary in the office who's a third cousin once removed of one of the parties. So then a party might just be, you know, looking to get out of having to bear the consequences of the case. You have to look at the context in which the objection is made and the reasonableness of the objection at the time. But obviously, judges have to be very, very careful from the standpoint of halakha to avoid not only impropriety, but of course, any appearance of impropriety as well. But Yisrael Nukim, you know, Me'ashem Mi'Yisrael. Okay, we'll stop here.